There will be, of course, a new round of hearings this week before Congress on the Flint water crisis. Today, former Flint emergency manager Darnell Early will be among those testifying. Also, Governor Rick Snyder and EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy are both scheduled to testify later in the week. Meanwhile, legislative hearings on the Flint water crisis are to begin in Lansing here today with a report from the state auditor general, bringing you up to speed on what's happening in Flint. This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us today. A longtime Ingham County official is in serious trouble with the law. Yesterday, County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III was arraigned on 15 criminal charges, most involving prostitution. One of the alleged crimes is a felony that carries up to a fine of up to 20 years in prison.
And finally, we are charging Mr. Dunnings with a felony for enticing a woman who had never before engaged in commercial sex to perform sexual acts with him in exchange for cash.
That was Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette explaining the charges against Dunnings yesterday. Schuette and Ingham County Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth also detailed 14 misdemeanor charges against the 63-year-old official. 10 counts of engaging in prostitution and 4 counts of neglect of duty. Our next guest has been aware for some time that authorities had concerns about Mr. Dunnings' actions. Todd Haywood is a reporter for the Lansing City Pulse. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Todd, for having me on.
When did you first become aware that law enforcement had concerns involving Stuart Dunnings?
We first became aware of the situation in early August, and we'll be detailing how we knew that in tomorrow's paper.
And interestingly, according to today's Lansing State Journal, Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth commented yesterday that there had been chatter, his word, chatter, about Mr. Dunnings in prostitution over the years. And this was yesterday's news was really part of a human trafficking sex ring. Can you take us back and remind us who is involved in this human trafficking sex ring and how it connected ultimately to Stuart Dunnings?
Sure. A gentleman by the name of Tyrone Smith was arrested by federal authorities last year for trafficking women after a 17-year-old girl was found beaten here in East Lansing, and she disclosed that she was being trafficked for sex. Federal authorities indicted him in August. He has since pled guilty. He's facing a minimum of 15 years in federal prison next month when he is officially sentenced. During that investigation, it came out that allegedly Prosecutor Dunnings and his brother Stephen Dunnings were allegedly visiting some of the women who had been trafficked. So that's sort of how we got to this point. Now, I think it's important to understand that Mr. Smith, this was not his first rodeo when it comes to crimes. He was convicted in 1996 of murder and spent 15 years in the state prison. So he was threatening some of these women with murder if they didn't perform sexual services as he demanded.
Now, the most serious charge against Stuart Dunnings is one felony charge, pandering. Remind us what pandering is and how that charge came to be lodged against him.
Well, essentially, pandering means that a woman or a man has been enticed into becoming a prostitute. And there's, I think there's 9 or 10 different framings that are used in the law for that. But essentially, it's saying, I'm going to make this person a prostitute.
And the Tyrone Smith case, that was the federal authorities were involved in that, were they not?
Or was correct. That was a federal investigation that resulted in a federal indictment and federal guilty plea. And they turned over as part of their investigation and grand jury investigation information to local authorities for an investigation.
We're talking with Todd Haywood of the Lansing City Pulse, who's been covering the story involving the charges against Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings. Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth told a local media outlet last evening that Mr. Dunnings got, in his words, lawyered up in the past month or so, suggesting that he became aware that he might be in some trouble here about a month ago. Do you know where Mr. Dunnings became aware of when Mr. Dunnings became aware that he might be under some kind of suspicion here?
I don't. I do know, however, that it was reported today, in fact, that Mr. Dunnings' attorney said that Mr. Dunnings had been aware of the investigation and had not intimidated any of the witnesses and had not fled and therefore was not a risk to the community in an argument for not having a high bail.
This is a local scandal, a local fall from grace that you don't see too often. What was your response last August when you first learned that that this was unfolding?
You know, when you have somebody like Stuart Dunnings who has been a top leader in fighting trafficking and prostitution and a lot of the problems that sort of plague our community, it's pretty shocking when you start getting this kind of information. And how do you pursue it? How do you dig it up?
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
The challenge for a reporter is just getting over that initial shock and then deciding how to move forward.
Right.
You nailed it. Some of that shock was also apparent, I think, in Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth's comments yesterday. Let's listen to those. He starts out here referring to Attorney General Bill Schuette's previous comments.
You know, he started out by saying this was a disheartening investigation. In my opinion, would be an understatement. I've known Stuart for a long time, done some campaigning together. This was a huge betrayal of his trust, his oath of office, his service to the people of this county. But you know what? I took an oath. Attorney General Schuette took an oath. Amber took an oath. Our FBI partners took an oath, and we did our job.
Now, as Sheriff Rigglesworth referred to an Amber in that bite, that's Detective Amber Kenny Hinojosa. Is it possible this investigation could grow, could include a lot more people? What do you know about that?
Sheriff Rigglesworth did say to me yesterday that he does have an ongoing investigation, and that will relate to some other stuff that we'll be reporting tomorrow as well in terms of the questions that we had.
Todd Haywood of the Lansing City Pulse is our guest here. We're talking about the challenges facing Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings. Is there a likelihood that other victims or persons with knowledge of this case might come forward? And is there an effort underway to try to connect with more victims?
Well, there's absolutely an effort underway. As you're aware, yesterday during that press conference, they announced a telephone number for victims or those with knowledge about the alleged crimes of Mr. Dunnings and his brother could contact. I definitely see law enforcement really pushing this forward, trying to find more victims, trying to find more information, trying to find more witnesses to be able to tell this story.
Mm. The attorney general said Mr. Dunnings paid for sex, quote, hundreds of times, unquote. I have yet to see any reference in the reporting to a spouse or a significant other in his life. Is he married? Is he not married? Do we know that?
They can't see me on the radio. I'm shrugging. I don't know. we've been trying to get that answer, and we don't know yet.
Not one reference in the reporting that I've read so far has indicated one way or the other. And you shared with us here that Mr. Dunnings' brother, Stephen Dunnings, also got involved as well. What can you tell us about him and his involvement here?
Well, he's a Lansing attorney, and he's been charged with two counts of misdemeanor engaging for prostitution, which is basically saying that he paid somebody for commercial sex.
It was reported that both Mr. Schuette and Mr. Rigglesworth encouraged Stuart Dunnings to resign from the office of prosecutor, suggesting, I guess, that technically at least, he is still the county prosecutor. Do you have any idea who's in charge of the prosecutor's office now?
My understanding is that Chief Assistant Prosecutor Lisa McCormick is running the office at this time, and you are correct. They have called for his resignation. This does place a burden. As you know, Sheriff Rigglesworth did say, look, if we have a case of prostitution that we bring and the charges don't get brought by the prosecutor, that's a problem for us right now with Mr. Dunnings still effectively the head of the prosecutor's office.
Well, it creates some electoral confusion as well, because county voters elect a prosecutor this November, and my understanding is that Mr. Dunnings, and indeed no one, has registered as a candidate yet.
That's correct. And they have until April 19th to do so. So I would not be surprised if we don't see a very active primary campaign as a result of this. But the other question that comes into play in all of this is, if Mr. Dunnings does resign, is who takes over the prosecutor's office?
Yeah.
Because Lisa McCormick does not live in the county, so she cannot be acting prosecuting attorney. So there's some real layers of questions about what's going to happen with this prosecutor's office over the next several months.
How well do you feel you came to know Stuart Dunnings in your work at City Pulse and elsewhere?
You know, I've had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Dunnings over the decades, and he's always been rather upright and forthright with me. So it's a little shocking and surprising to see this kind of situation unfolding the way it is.
And tell us how you and your City Pulse colleagues intend to cover this in the coming weeks. Are there approaches? Are there angles here that you know you want to explore here?
We honestly have not gotten into that depth of conversation yet as to exactly what areas we're going to cover. We do have some stuff that'll come out on Wednesday that will certainly add some clarity, I think, to some of the allegations that have been made against Mr. Dunnings and his brother.
Maybe it's my imagination here, but it seems like the amount of reporting that you're contributing to the Lansing City Pulse has gone up in recent months. Is that my imagination, or are you really creating more reporting for the paper these days?
You know, I'm incredibly blessed to have the opportunity to really sort of get in there and start writing, and Burl has been very good at saying, here's the space, fill it up.
Yeah. How? Tell us about other stories that you're covering right now.
Well, I'm working on a piece looking at what's happening with the city attorney in Lansing.
Don't know much about that.
There's
a lot of mystery surrounding Janine McIntyre.
And a lot of questions. And city council has lots of questions that they'll be asking on March 21st. So we'll sort of be previewing some of those questions in this coming edition as well. And I think, you know, one of the other things we're looking at is the ongoing debate about the power substation at the corner of Washington and Malcolm X. And the elimination of the Scott Center and that park there on the corner. Some real debate in the community going on about that and the Board of Water and Light's plans and sort of their quickness to make that happen, and community sort of pushing back on that.
So, how hard was it to keep quiet back in August for all these months after you learned that Stuart Dunnings was involved and started to appear in this investigation?
Well, you know, Mark, we hear stuff all the time as reporters, as sort of people that people confide in, right? You learn to sort of put that stuff into little compartments.
Exactly.
Throughout your brain. So honestly, you don't think about it very often until there's something that triggers it. Because there's, you know, how do you as a reporter get this without interfering with an investigation, without, you know, following our ethical standards and strictures.
It's very tricky. It's very challenging sometimes. We want to thank Todd Haywood of the Lansing City Pulse for all of his insights involving all of the challenges facing Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III. We'll keep an eye on your reporting. Thanks for joining us, Todd.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, a new report from University of Michigan scientists says the Chinook salmon population in Lake Huron is unlikely to bounce back from a decade-long decline. We talk to U of M researcher Sarah Alderstein Gonzalez about what's behind the decline and what lay ahead for Great Lakes salmon. That's coming up. Well, tonight marks the opening of the 54th annual Ann Arbor Film Festival, which will run through Sunday. The majority of the over 200 screenings and presentations for this week-long festival will take place at the Michigan Theater downtown Ann Arbor, but there will be a few other satellite events as well in what promises to be a busy week. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke yesterday with the executive director of the festival, Leslie Raymond.
When we think of film, it's a very static medium for the majority, because when you have the final cut, that's about it. But there is several instances of this upcoming festival where that's not going to be the case.
You mean the ones that are not just specifically for a passive observation?
Exactly.
Yeah. So the one that comes to mind first is Graham Weinbrin's 78 Letters. It's going to play on the Sunday of the festival in the main in the afternoon, I believe at 3 p.m. And this is a work where he's got 60-second clips that are all associated with different letters of the alphabet, and the audience will be telling him there and then in the theater which ones to put on. So this should be very interesting. I've never seen the performance myself, so I'm going to be excited to see, like, how does everybody tell him how to put what letter on next? Or is everybody going to shout or hold up their hand, or, you know, what will that be like? He's been performing it for a while, and he keeps adding to it. So there will be a couple of new chapters, shall we say, for his Ann Arbor performance.
And there's also very interesting light music, which is not a single projection element. Could you talk about that? Because as I'm reading about it, when you have something called light music, it's very difficult to get that coming across in the text as you're reading about it.
So this is called Light Music by Liz Rhodes. It's actually a historical piece that our curator, David Donnell, selected to show at the Ann Arbor Arts Center. It's two 16-millimeter projectors. They point at screens that face each other. So there'll be a screen at each end of the room and a projector at each end of the room pointing towards the other screen. And the audience is invited to walk in between, so their own presence and their shadow and obstruction of the image is a part of it. The sound is generated from the optical soundtrack of the film. So the way that old celluloid film works in playing the sound is that there's a soundtrack embedded in the edge that light shines through and makes the sound. So the actual images are quite abstract and then actually just kind of spill out into that portion of the film strip. And so the sound head reads based on what the black and white abstract images are.
We're speaking with Leslie Raymond, the executive director of the 54th Annual Ann Arbor Film Festival, the longest-running independent and experimental film festival in North America. And Leslie, with that kind of legacy, I think much of the public might think it is, you know, art film lovers only kind of affair. But in the interactive element of the programming you have, there's an all-ages component to the festival as well.
Well, let's see. That's true. There's going to be the Saturday morning family-friendly program. We call it for ages 6 and up. It's actually technically our Films in Competition 5 program of short films. It will be opened by a shadow puppet show by Tom Carey, who's a local artist here, which will be really, really fun. So preceding that 11 o'clock screening on Saturday, we'll have Game Start School here. They'll be around all week, but they're going to come in an hour early that morning, and they're doing a lobby activity where they're helping people design digital characters that will populate a game space. And then the idea is to take these characters that have been created all week long, including that morning of family-friendly films, and put them into like a 2 or 3 minute clip that we can show at the awards screening. I also want to say with the family-friendly program, we do gear it towards kids, young kids, in terms of being content appropriate, and then we take into account their attention span. But it is meant for people of all ages, and we actually see this as a really great, if you've never been to the film festival before, this is a really great sort of intro to it. It gives you a broad range of the kinds of things we show, experimental, animation, but also narrative and documentary, and just, you know, gives you a chance to dip your foot in and see what it's like.
Again, that's Saturday's Films in Competition 5, gear for ages 6 and up. Later on for Saturday, the Ann Arbor Film Festival has a workshop called Shoot, Scratch, and Stomp, which in this smartphone world where people have digital cameras with them at all times, apparently, well, Shoot, Scratch, and Stomp aims to get people used to using actual film.
Everybody will be shooting Super 8 film, the actual film, which is quite incredible that's... Yeah. Made a comeback, right?
Yeah, right.
And actually, one of our sponsors is Kodak this year, and they're making film again, and they're actually making Super 8 cameras again. So, and they'll actually be donating the Super 8 film for that program. And then after shooting film, people will be doing hand processing in some kind of eco-friendly solution, something like coffee grounds and dishwashing soap. I don't know the details of it, but it sounds pretty cool. And then they're going to have a chance to also do like scratching on film and manipulating it by hand. So it should be a lot of fun.
Actually, that's a good question, because there is that trend of moving away from the actual film stock and going into digital. How has that process been? Do you see that transition to DCP, to digital protection?
I mean, technology is always going to evolve. And I think our festival really championed 16 for a long time. There was heyday of avant-garde filmmaking in the 60s, the 50s, when all of these cameras, the Canon Scoopix after the war, became available for pedestrian use. And a lot of artists gravitated towards working with film. It was cheap compared to now, especially. And so there's this incredible sort of just blossoming of avant-garde film being made when our film festival started in 1963. I mean, even with video, analog video on the scene, the festival is still very dedicated and committed, and I, as an artist, completely embrace that as well. I think seeing the projected analog video image just, you know, aesthetically not anywhere near, you know, the beauty of film. So the festival held on to that for a long time and then finally embraced video when digital came on the scene. And I think we saw a lot of our makers moving to that medium. And then over the course of this last decade, just having to roll with all the different digital formats, and then now, as you say, DCP, and seeing, you know, more filmmakers learning how to do that. I mean, the Michigan Theater can play DCPs. They can ingest our material into their system. But we still have a lot of work that we just have in digital format. But also, I think 20% of what we're showing is celluloid, 16 millimeter, some 35 millimeter.
In addition to the film-centric screenings and events, there'll also be a few other surprises downtown as part of the Ann Arbor Film Festival this week.
Flat Sitter is going to have a giant inflatable bubble in the Michigan Theater lobby, and they're going to invite people to come in for a virtual reality Oculus Rift experience. So Kyle Marler will be here running that project all throughout the week. We'll have Martin Thoburn's telephone piece in the old telephone booth of the Michigan Theater, which will be an interactive artwork.
And I think, if I recall, there's an involvement with Eastern Michigan at some of that as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. The lobby decorations, actually, we'll be installing them tonight. And Chris Riley's classes at Eastern Michigan University have been working with recycled materials, with actually water bottles. I think maybe some of it to call attention to our water situation in our neighboring community of Flint. But we're looking forward to seeing what his class comes up with, and we're really excited to just have them on board to do something cool.
Plenty of cool things coming to downtown Ann Arbor now through Sunday as part of the 54th Annual Ann Arbor Film Festival. You can find more information about the schedule at aafilmfestival.org. We've been speaking with the executive director of the festival, Leslie Raymond, ahead of this very full program. Leslie, thanks for speaking with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, Lapeer-based author William Anderson has written extensively about Laura Ingalls Wilder. His latest title is The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. He talks with Scott Pohl about the project ahead of two Michigan bookstore appearances this week. That's coming up after the break on Current State. Scott Pohl has our staff music pick of the week this week, and today we're going to hear from a Canadian singer named Angel Forrest. She was another one of your finds at the International Blues Challenge in Memphis in January.
That's right, Mark. Angel Forrest wasn't in the competition. She was there to support friends like guitarist Paul Delaurier. But she did sing at a jam session I attended. Last week, she released a CD called Angels 11. She co-wrote all of the songs with her husband, Dennis Coulombe. It's something of a concept album with 11 tracks featuring a different guitarist on every song. Paul Delaurier plays the guitar on Goodbye.
It's a true blue story about a boy that couldn't cry. He stopped loving she said goodbye.
A little later in the song, the pace picks up and first starts to channel Janis Joplin.
Please don't take your love.
The song is Goodbye from the new Angel Forest album, Angels 11. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
Current State, three times every weekday on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, every day at noon on AM 870, always at WKAR.org. Chinook salmon fishing was once a thriving business on Lake Huron. It helped support a significant tourism industry in Michigan's Thumb and was a favorite among sport fishermen. But in the past decade, the lake's salmon population has taken a nosedive. A new study from the University of Michigan found that the fish are unlikely to bounce back, and researchers say that isn't necessarily a bad thing. To learn more, we turn to Sarah Alderstein Gonzalez, a research scientist at the University of Michigan and co-author of the study. Sarah, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
How significant has the decline of Chinook salmon in Lake Erie been in the past decade or so? What's happened?
What happened is that the population just went down without signs to be prepared for this. So I started being concerned with the situation in Lake Huron mostly because of the human side, not because of the sustainability of the lake side, and decided that I needed to put my thoughts together and modeling skills and take all the information available at the lake, which is not that much. It's one of the forgotten lakes, actually. To look into the Chinook decline, and had one of my students actually ready to start his PhD, and he got also interested in this, but mostly from the point of view of the alewives, not so much for the Chinook. So I was more interested in the effects on the human and economic side, and he was more interested from the ecological point of view, what caused the alewife decline, which is the prey of Chinook salmon, in the lake. So this was a very good combination of putting our skills together.
Understood. I misspoke a moment ago, too. I said Lake Erie. We're talking about Lake Huron here.
Yes, so Lake Huron. Lake Erie is a totally different beast.
Indeed. What are the biggest factors in these declines, though, just briefly?
Yeah, well, the lake in his natural state is actually a low productivity lake, right? The lakes are very similar in many ways, but also very different. And you mentioned Lake Erie. That's a very productive lake. Lake Huron, it's not.
What does that mean? What does that mean, a very productive lake?
Not that many nutrients. So productivity of the lake, it's low. You can't have that much life in it, if you wish, right?
There are fewer fish, then, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it cannot sustain that many fish because there's not that much to eat in the first place. But then with human intervention, nutrients started going into the lake, right? So there's more nutrients from what we have in our households that we put out there and the farming and the nutrients and all that. So the lake was a little bit more productive than it should have been, way more productive and more nutrients. And then you have invasive species coming in, hundreds of them, and some that actually become invasives in the lake, like the alewives, these little prey fish.
And indeed, that's why Chinook salmon were introduced in the first place, to try to deal with the problem of these invasive alewives back in the 1960s. Now, is part of the current issue the fact that the salmon have taken care of the problem that they were introduced to solve?
Oh, yeah. So, but the other thing is that the managers thought that this was a good opportunity not only to get rid of the alewives, but also to create this economic opportunity, right, with the Chinook salmon fishery, which was very successful and blooming in the 80s. But that, in retrospect, you know, could have never be sustainable because they were introduced to get rid of the alewives. The alewives at some point will go down. Plus, you had the zebra mussels and quagga mussels coming into the lake, which were sucking in more the nutrients, putting it on the bottom, right, in the bentos, where the fish are not feeding on them, except for some poor whitefish that ended up feeding on the on these zebra mussels, but in reality, they were sucking some of the nutrients and out, and then the Chinook salmon were reproducing also naturally, right? So they started being introduced by stocking, but years after, they started reproducing naturally, and that wasn't known. But then the Chinook population was too high, right? So the combination of the zebra mussels and the Chinook salmon and the alewives was something that could not be forever the same way. Mm. And the zebra mussels went down. The quagga mussels are still expanding. The Chinook salmon are down. The alewives are gone. And the nutrients are being controlled also by management. So the lake is going back to a more natural state, which is a good thing for the system, not for the recreational fishermen and people that depend on the Chinook salmon for their livelihoods.
Well, see, that was kind of my bottom line question here. As a scientist, Sarah, speaking in ecological terms here for a moment, mm-hmm. what yeah. is the most desirable scenario? Are you saying that a Lake Huron with fewer Chinook salmon is the most desirable scenario?
Yeah, you want the lake trout to come back. Those are the original, the ones that were here before, being the only predator. And you had Lake Herring as one of the prey fish. It would be very nice, and walleye being more coastal, and yellow perch. That's what you want. That's the natural state of the lake, not of all these invasive species.
Sarah Alderstein-Gonzalez is a research scientist at the University of Michigan. We're talking about a new study that says Lake Huron's Chinook salmon fishery is unlikely to recover from the steep decline it has experienced in recent years. Is there a movement afoot? There must be some number of sport fishermen who want to keep Chinook salmon in Lake Huron. How is that discussion playing out?
Oh, yeah. There are lots of fishermen that like to fish for Chinook salmon. In fact, I remember being in many of these outreach meetings that DNR puts out to talk about the fisheries in the lake, and asking the recreational fishermen what they wanted DNR to do. And the fishermen consistently answer that they wanted the DNR to keep stocking Chinook salmon with the hope that they will recover. So, yes, there's a lot of fishermen out there and people that depended on that fishery. So, say, restaurant owners or anybody who depended on the tourism industry in the southern Huron will want to see the economy bouncing back. And but the reality is that you have to adapt and have to understand that, you can have as much fun, you know, fishing for lake trout or walleye, and it's much better. So if you could educate or make people understand what is sustainable in the lake and equate that to a better economy, then that'll be the way to go. Hmm. But yeah, there are lots of fishermen that do want Chinook because they say they fight back. I don't know.
Oh yeah.
I'm not a recreational fisherman, so I cannot.
Is the DNR restocking the lake with Chinook these days, or have they stopped that, or what's the status of that?
They stopped in the south, but they're still stocking in the north.
Is it possible that not restocking Chinook in Lake Huron could lead to a resurgence of alewives there?
Probably not. I think the alewives are pretty much gone, so doesn't matter what you do now.
I understand there are some alewives and there are some Chinook salmon also in Lake Michigan here. Tell us about what's happening in Lake Michigan. Does it parallel what's going on and what's happened in Lake Huron?
Well, we are seeing some of the similar signs. It's still, of course, it's still not gone, but it's not how it used to be. And some of the signs, so you have the same players, right? You also have the zebra and quagga mussels. And in fact, the quagga mussels are expanding in Lake Michigan, and they are more abundant based on the surveys available. So, but it is, Lake Michigan is a more productive lake. So as I said, we think of the Great Lakes as being pretty much similar, but they are not. And Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, although they are kind of the same lake, they are connected and all that, Lake Michigan is more productive than Lake Huron. But there's still a limit to how much production you can have and how much consumption you can have. So it's going to depend on how the nutrient trends are going and how much the quaggas are expanding. The Chinook salmon, I think, at least what the model exercise that we did showed, is that the alewives would have not collapsed if the zebra mussels wouldn't have gone into a system, right? So the Chinook salmon by themselves and the alewives would have gone along for a long time if conditions would have been stable otherwise.
We've got to leave it there, Sarah. We've been talking about a new study from the University of Michigan that suggests Chinook salmon fishing in Lake Huron could soon be a thing of the past. Our guest today has been research scientist Sarah Alderstein-Gonzalez. Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark. My pleasure.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Few American writers have enjoyed the loyalty of their readers as much as Laura Ingalls Wilder. Her Little House on the Prairie books have sold millions of copies, and they inspired the long-running TV show in the 1970s and 80s. Lapeer, Michigan-based author William Anderson has written extensively about her life, and he recently spoke with Scott Pohl about his latest. What's the focus of the new book, Scott?
Well, Mark, it's called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. He'll visit the Schuller Bookstore in Grand Rapids tonight and the Schullers in the Eastwood Town Center on Wednesday to talk about it. Anderson tells me that he considered about 500 Laura Ingalls Wilder letters for this collection, choosing those that he felt were most representative of her and her writing. William Anderson, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
Tell me what drew you to the works of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
It's a long story, and it trails back to elementary school. And I was one of the millions of school kids across America that were exposed to, indoctrinated in Wilder's series of books on pioneering. And I didn't know it at the time in third grade, but in elementary classrooms all over, teachers were reading those books and coordinating them with studies of Native Americans and pioneer frontier life. And I can remember my third grade teacher saying to us, as she took the book Little House on the Prairie off her shelf and began to read it, that you children will learn more about the pioneers from this book than our social studies book. And that went on to daily readings of those adventures of the Ingalls family as they made the long covered wagon trek to Kansas from Wisconsin and built up a new home. And all of those adventures that we read about in the books, we tried to duplicate in the classroom. We built a teepee. Of course, we churned butter and had cornbread and mapped out the journey and a big poster. So it was really a cross-literary and historical experience for us kids.
Was the Little House on the Prairie TV show a factor at that time? I'm not sure how old you are, how long ago you're talking about here.
We're talking about the late 60s when I heard the books. The television series was a product of the mid-70s to the mid-80s, and by that time, I was working as a summer tour guide at the Wilder home site, Ingalls Family Homestead in De Smet, South Dakota. What a great summer job that was. And the television series debuted about that time, and we quickly had to revamp our descriptions of the historic houses because we had TV visitors and the book reader visitors, and they were a completely different world. So the television show really did not follow the books very carefully.
I want to ask you what's in the stories of Laura Ingalls Wilder for the children of the 21st century.
Well, when Wilder first wrote those books in the 30s and 40s, she saw in her own life a huge transition from a family that traveled maybe 18, 20 miles max in a day by a covered wagon to owning a car on her rural farm in Mansfield, Missouri, and she traveled swiftly by train. She made a plane flight. She had electricity, radio, everything had changed so radically from her childhood, and that's one of the things that impelled her to write these books. She said that she wanted American children to know about the beginnings of things in this country, and she saw, you know, that way of life had just about vanished by her 60s when she started writing the books. And that was one of her reasons. The other reason for writing the books was economic. She had always been interested in writing and had a career as a country journalist. And her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, was the real literary star in the family. She was a best-selling author in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And Laura wanted to try her hand at writing. And when the family's money was wiped out in the Depression, that seemed a good time for her to start writing books for children.
We're talking with William Anderson, author of The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder and other books about Laura Ingalls Wilder. He'll be visiting the Schuler Bookstore in Grand Rapids Tuesday night and the Schuler Eastwood Town Center store on Wednesday. Tell me about these letters. Who did she write letters to?
When I wrote the initial biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder that I did a number of years ago, I accessed a lot of her letters as resource material. She didn't keep any diaries to speak of in her adult life. We know of her pioneer childhood. It's like an open book. But after she grew up and moved with her husband to Rocky Ridge Farm in Missouri, there isn't much in her own words to tell about that way of life, except in the letters. And the bulk of her papers and correspondence are kept at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in Iowa, and I studied those letters a lot in writing the biography and other assorted books that I've done. And I always had in the back of my mind that it would be good to put together a collection of her correspondence. And I had all these file folders labeled by year and the photocopies of the letters stuck in. So finally it came to fruition last year. HarperCollins, her publisher and my publisher, asked me if I would do this project, and it was fun putting it all together.
Well, who was she writing to, and what was she writing about?
Well, the first part of the book, she was writing about concerns of a farm wife. She wrote for the Missouri Ruralist, so she had an editor there that she corresponded with. She wrote to her friends, her family. And the heart of the book is, to me, the lengthy correspondence that she carried on with her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, while the Little House books were being created. Because Laura and Rose had a collaborative teamwork in the making of those books. So we learn about her craft, and we learn about how those books were actually made. Finally, the book is full of her responses to her fans, and she got thousands of fan letters every year, lots, interestingly enough, from Michigan. So I included some of the letters she wrote to school children and librarians, teachers, and so on in Detroit, Saginaw, Mount Pleasant, even East Jordan, Michigan. So Michigan has a role in this book.
Here's something I'm curious about. How are these letters similar to the Little House books, and how are they different? Here's what I'm getting at. Being private correspondents, was she letting her hair down? You know, her readers know her primarily as a child and as a young woman. What was the older woman, Laura Ingalls Wilder, like? Do we see much of that in these letters?
I think we do, particularly in her correspondence with her daughter, Rose. We see her as a very tough-minded person. When they would debate on how the book should progress or what the theme of the book should be or characterization, they could pitch a pretty heated battle between them. And I think that Laura was a strong character. Her books hint at that. Remember, when she married Almanzo Wilder, she refused to allow the word obey to be used in the wedding ceremony. So she was a woman that knew how to stand her ground. And in her correspondence with her agents and editors, she made it very plain that she expected to be paid top dollar for her work.
I want to ask you about a couple other areas of interest that you've written about. One is the Trapp family. What inspired your interest in the family from The Sound of Music?
Well, the Von Trapps run a lodge in Stowe, Vermont, Trapp Family Lodge, which was their home after they came here to America. And on one of our family vacations when I was a kid, we stopped there and visited. And that was after the movie Sound of Music had made such an imprint on American culture. And I read about the Von Trapps, got to know them because they still own and operate the lodge. And when I was a young journalist, they had a grand reopening of their new lodge after the previous one had burned. And I was sent up there by several magazines to cover that story. So I got to know the Trapps pretty well, and then my Japanese translator and publisher said to me one time, you know, Japan is so fascinated by this movie and by the Von Trapps, we really need a book about their real lives, and you seem to know them well. So I did the first version of the book, The World of the Trapp Family, for my Japanese publisher, and then it came out in Chinese. And then we did the American edition. So it was just a very serendipitous process that developed that book.
You also collaborated with Wally Bronner of the famous Bronner's Christmas Wonderland in Frankenmuth on his book.
I did, and that connects with the Von Trapps as well, because several members of the family came to Bronner's to do appearances, sign books, sign my book with me. And I remember saying to Wally just offhandedly, you know, Wally, people that come to Bronner's, they must look around at this tremendous place and wonder what was the origin of it. And he told me that story many times, how he started out as a sign painter. And then I heard from Wally later, and he said, Bill, will you help me write my autobiography? And that was a pleasure working with Wally, a great guy, and he is much missed today at Bronner's. But the book exists to tell the wonderful story of how that place was created.
William Anderson will talk about his latest book, The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder, Tuesday at 7 at the Schuller Bookstore in Grand Rapids. He'll also be at the Schuller Store in the Eastwood Town Center in Lansing on Wednesday at 7 p.m. William Anderson, thank you.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Governor Snyder's proposed budget has triggered a conversation about how to improve mental and behavioral health care in the state. Tomorrow's guest, Robert Sheehan, director of the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards, talks about the changes he thinks are necessary. We hope you can join us tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. Beware the Ides of March. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.